This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The focus in Washington in recent weeks has been on international issues, the possible summit with President Trump and Kim Jong-un, tariff policies, and a new policy designed to divide parents and children seeking asylum protection. With Congress focused on various primaries and the November general election, Congress is relatively quiet. But the Robert Mueller probe, with all of its tentacles, is never far from anyone's consciousness. To explore these and other national and international issues, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Welcome, Howard and Ken, to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you.
Hi, guys.
Ken, let's get started right away with a trivia question that you have for us, and then I'll let the audience know where they can flood the phone lines and give us the right answer.
Now, you want a correct trivia question, is that correct?
Yes, that would be a good idea. Okay. One that's been checked and double-checked.
Okay, I got it. Okay, well, with the primaries going on almost every week now, and it's still and after the Ohio primary is come and gone, Ohio voters have never elected a woman as governor or senator, which is still pretty remarkable. So the trivia question, though, is what is the largest state by population that has never elected a woman as governor or senator?
So the largest state by population that's never had, never elected.
And the reason I say never elected is, of course, Nancy Hollister was briefly governor of Ohio, but she was not elected. So
she
never
was appointed.
Elected.
Yes, right.
Right. Okay. She succeeded, right, exactly.
And elected. We're talking about elected.
Okay. Right. And governor or senator. So that that makes it kind of interesting as well. All right. Well, if people want to join in on that, think you have the answer, please call us at 513-419-7100. The person with the right answer will get a coveted Ken Rudin political junkie button to wear proudly. Okay. So let's get started. I think a lot of eyes are turned right now to New York, where a very high-ranking Kim Jong-sul is come to the United States to meet with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And one of the issues that seems to have emerged in this whole figuring out how to get ready for the proposed summit is the possibility of ending the Korean War with an official treaty. Now, it ended in 1953 with an armistice, but no peace treaty. So, Ken, my question is, what would North Korea gain from such a move? And, you know, what would the United States and South Korea have to give up? I mean, what's the give and take here?
Well, that's the question that obviously needs to be decided. I think that was one of the reasons why it was canceled to begin with. It's just the whole thing fascinates me in the fact that the thought of Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un having they seem so far apart ideologically and you know, personality wise and temperamentally is more most important, and yet they have the potential, or at least Donald Trump has the potential, that recent presidents Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, George Bush, W. Bush could not accomplish, and that is somehow sitting down with the North Koreans and working on a deal. The question is, what is the North Koreans willing to give up, and what are they willing to demand of the U.S.? The thought of giving up their nuclear weapons, I know Donald Trump has talked about that as a goal, and John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, has talked about that. That's exactly what they should do before sanctions are lifted. But I can't see North Korea doing that. I mean, the only reason North Korea is seen in such awe by the world is because of his nuclear capability. So ultimately, the goal of the North and South Korea is perhaps unification, but more importantly, denuclearization of the peninsula with no R at the end. But the question is whether they can work that out in Singapore or wherever they decide to hold these meetings. And of course, the United States is not willing to pull its troops out of Korea, you know, which is one of the demands that Kim is likely to make.
And the thing about Kim Jong-un, he's told the Russian foreign minister just yesterday said that, you know, getting rid of nuclear weapons while the sanctions are still in place is just totally out of the question. So you've got this kind of chicken and egg thing. You know, Trump is saying, you know, we're going to put these sanctions, we're going to keep these sanctions on you, and well, we're not going to do anything about nuclear weapons until the sanctions are gone.
Well, that's why I'm trying to figure out how a peace treaty ending the war actually fits into all of this, and you know, what does it concretely mean? Plus, if I understand correctly, China would have to be involved in this. I mean, they are a signatory to the armistice in 1953.
Well, not only would China have to be involved in it, I think the United States knows that. And so it's interesting. Maybe we'll talk about tariffs in a bit. But it's interesting that for all the tough language that Trump has been making about instituting of tariffs, he seems every now and then to let China off the hook because he knows he needs Chinese cooperation. And not only does he need Chinese cooperation, he needs a united American front. And there seems to be some divisions between the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, into how to deal with North Korea. Bolton has said that, I mean, Bolton has once upon a time argued for the invasion of North Korea or the bombing of North Korea, which, of course, the folks in Pyongyang absolutely are aware of. And he also said that maybe that Kim of North Korea should follow the Gaddafi model of Libya, that because Gaddafi, under prodding from George W. Bush administration, gave up his nuclear weapons in 2003, and that was fine. But everybody also knows that Gaddafi was murdered by his own people in 2011. So Kim, the thought of wanting to be the next Gaddafi is not something that they're very comfortable with happening.
And I think that's one of the reasons why there's this on-again, off-again thing, because Trump is getting mixed messages, you know, from John Bolton and then a different message from others in his administration about whether or not they should go forward with this.
Well,
but isn't it strange, Howard? Howard, don't you find it strange that the president stands up and says, we're canceling this thing. It's not working. Yeah. We don't like what you're saying. We're canceling it. And then immediately everybody's scrambling to make it happen. Why cancel it to begin with? I mean, the negotiations haven't even started yet.
It's baffling. And the only explanation I can have is it's what I always go back to about Donald Trump is that it's kind of the last person who speaks to him. Last person who has his ear is what he does or what he tweets out.
Well, I think there, also is a case here where he would argue that by calling it off, he was raising the ante. And there have been suggestions that the fact that the North Koreans have gone as far as they have, especially after they received the letter they did from Trump, may indicate that Kim Jong-un really needs something too to secure his position, that he may not be as absolutely in control of things in North Korea as we may believe from the outside. So I think there's a bigger dynamic here, and I think Trump would legitimately raise the question of, you know, I called their bluff and they came running back, and that may
be
his style.
That seems to be the Trump. That seems to be the Trump philosophy in almost every deal he makes. Same thing with the tariffs.
Well, in fact, yes.
Call their bluff. Make them demand concessions. Make them by making a tough deal, forcing concessions, and then making them come back with concessions. But that's not happening with tariffs. Doesn't seem to be happening with North Korea either. Look. He was elected. In his mind, he is the art of the deal. He wrote the art of the deal. His persuasion capabilities are the things that, you know, will get him not only as a great businessman but as president of the United States. And I don't think foreign policy works that way. So I think Trump, you know, is sometimes deluded by his own past, even though his own past is checkered as well, given the bankruptcies and the failures and the lawsuits when he was in business in New York. But the fact is, I think he just feels that he can talk his way into a deal, get the other side to give up things they ordinarily wouldn't get to get a deal. That may not happen with tariffs. That may not happen with North Korea.
Well, let's take a look at this tariff situation, because there is breaking news on that. And there was a deadline of tomorrow on the extension that he gave our allies, putting China aside for a moment. That's another set of tariffs. But this morning it was announced that the 25% tariff on steel and the 10% tariff on aluminum on the EU, the European Union, Canada, and Mexico, all our allies, that's going into effect as of midnight tonight. So is that for real, or is that a bargaining chip about NAFTA? What's going on here?
See, I know that anybody tuning in and wants to hear about politics, they may say, well, I don't think I care about tariffs. But what they should care about is the way the president has dealt with U.S. allies. I mean, while he's afraid to say anything, he will never say anything critical about Putin. And he seems more and more deferential about China. The fact that he's completely willing to put tough tariffs on the U.S. allies, the European Union, Canada, and Mexico, with steel, with aluminum. Now he's talking about a 25% tariff on automobiles, which, of course, would affect Germany and Japan and South Korea and other allies as well. And it just tells the world that the United States may not be a reliable trading partner. And if you're going to single out your allies, and if you're going to just bully them, which I hate to, I can't think of any other way to put it. It is a bullying thing. They tried to get negotiations. They tried to renegotiate NAFTA. South Korea did make concessions, and they're not part of these new tariffs. Brazil, Argentina, Australia also gave in, made concessions. The fact that the European Union not only is not giving in on these concessions, but they're saying, okay, if you're going to do this, we'll do the same. We're going to impose tremendous tariffs on American products. Mexico is saying the same thing.
Right.
I mean, it'd be a trade war that Trump seems to welcome, but the American consumer may ultimately pay the price.
These allies, I mean, they're as Ken says, they can fight back. And they can fight back by imposing all these tariffs on things, everything from Harley motorcycles to any kind of product that we
fruit
ship
and vegetables.
Overseas. Fruit and vegetables, yeah.
So
they can fight back, and there will be a trade war if he persists in this.
With the Canada and Mexico tariffs going into effect tonight, where does renegotiating NAFTA stand?
Well, I mean, the renegotiation has been from the beginning since the president talked about instituting these tariffs, and nothing has happened. The allies have not backed down. They have not. The United States has always said from the beginning, and Trump has said this well before he was a candidate, that other countries like China, and justifiably so, and that China has manipulated the world currency and instituted unfair tariffs against American products, that there's a trade deficit with these countries because of these these kind of practices. But at the same time, the fact that negotiations are not, and they also said that, look, We're still negotiating with China, even though we're not happy with their trade policies. So there's no reason why we can't still negotiate with our allies while these tariffs go into effect. But I think the allies are not going to see it that way. They're going to say, you do this to us, we'll do it. You're going to pull my hair, I'm going to pull your hair. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to accomplish anything except inflame relations with ostensible allies of the United States.
Well, Ken, we're going to have to take a break, but I would like for you to restate the trivia question for today before we take the break and give people a little bit of time to consider it and then call in. We've got a number of callers lined up, but I think we would like to give other people a chance.
Well, basically, with this being, according to a lot of people, this being the year of the woman, with so many female candidates running for office, the trivia question is, what is the largest state by population that has never elected a woman as governor or senator?
Okay. Largest state by population. So we're going to start with Tim. Tim, you think you have the answer to the question? Yes. What's your answer?
I love this segment. Love the political junkie every month. Look forward to it every month.
Great.
I think
Thank
the
you,
answer
Tim.
Is Florida.
Florida.
Well, Florida, let's see. No, Florida elected Paula Hawkins as a senator in 1980. She lost 6 years later to Bob Graham. She served one term as senator, so it's not Florida. That's a good guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so we had...
Never elected a woman governor, though.
We did have somebody else who had Florida, but they dropped off when they heard that answer. Now we have Jim. Jim, you have a possible answer here, maybe the right answer.
I think, I know it's not California, New York, Texas, or Arizona. Okay. I think it's Georgia.
You think it's Georgia? Okay. How about Georgia, Ken?
Georgia has never elected a woman, although I just want to say for trivia's sake, Stacey Abrams is the Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia this year, Democrat. She's the first black woman ever to be nominated ever for governor of any state. But having said that, Georgia has never elected a woman governor or senator, but it's not the largest state to have done that or not done that.
Okay. Is Georgia larger than Ohio population-wise?
Nope.
I didn't think so. Okay. Nope. We have another caller, and Judy, you have a guess, which is not either Florida or Georgia. What's your suggestion?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania is the correct answer.
Good job.
There have been women. I mean, the most famous one I would think is that in 1992, the so-called Year of the Woman, Lynn Yackel ran a very strong race against Arlen Specter, and that was in response to the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings. But she was a never elected senator, and they've never elected a woman governor of Pennsylvania either. Pennsylvania has a slightly larger population than Ohio. Yes. Pennsylvania is the correct answer.
Very good.
Yes,
Howard, did you have that right?
There it is.
There it is. I can vouch for Howard. He writes it down early on, and then he can be tested on this. So congratulations, Emily. Judy. Hang on. And you're the winner of the Political Junkie button for this
the
month.
Coveted.
But really,
the
you
coveted.
Think about it, there are a whole lot of states that haven't done this. You know.
Well, there's a lot of conditions there. Haven't done it, but are they bigger than
are
us?
Are they bigger than us? And, yeah.
You know,
right.
There's all kinds of things going on there. Mm-hmm. So,
but you also think... Can I just say, you also think of like California and New York, you think of, you know, bastions of liberal politics, but neither California and New York has ever elected a woman as governor.
Yeah, right.
Never California, never New York, and that's one of the things that I know irk women's groups around the country, the fact that California never, New York never. But that's just for governor.
That's
of
governor.
Course, the senator... Right. The senator in California, there are two women in the Senate, and you've had Kirsten Gillibrand, Hillary Clinton in New York.
Okay. So picking up on sort of the elected political theme, let's talk about the upcoming primaries, particularly the California primary. And Howard, there is a bit of an unusual character of the way that the primary is run in California, a little different than what happens certainly here in Ohio and in lots of states.
Well, California has a two-tiered system in these congressional elections. And I think I'll start this discussion by saying if the Democrats have any real hope of winning control of the U.S. House in November, they've got to pick up seats in California. Pick up Republican seats in California. But it's very difficult because of this two-tiered system where you end up with multiple candidates running for the top two positions and the top two candidates.
They're not running in parties. They're just running.
I mean, they're obviously Democrats. They're obviously Republicans. They're green or whatever. But the top two finishers are the ones who face each other in the fall for that House seat. Dana Rohrabacher, who's represented a district in Orange County for something like 30 years, right, Ken?
I think since the Reagan. Yeah, since the Reagan administration.
Since
86.
That's right.
88.
And he's running, and there is a second Republican who has a pretty good resume who's also in this race.
Scott Bell.
And then you have eight Democrats. And the Democratic vote is getting split all over the map. And the chances of one of those Democrats finishing in the top two is greatly diminished. And it's like I don't know what kind of strategy the Democratic National Committee or the California Democratic Party used to go after these seats. But whatever it is, it wasn't very very well thought out strategically.
Ken, what do you think about that? Now we're getting to the question of Democratic strategy about retaking the entire House and how they could bungle it in a state
like
California.
In places like California.
Yeah, there's no question that if the Democrats are going to take control of the House in November, California gives them great opportunity. There are at least 7 or 8 Republican seats that are vulnerable. Howard mentioned Dana Rohrabacher. That's definitely one of them that the Democrats could take over. The problem is, with this top two system that all the candidates, just to repeat, all the candidates run on the same ballot during the primary. There's no separate Democratic primary or Republican primary. All the candidates are on the same ballot, and the top two finishers, regardless of party, move on to November. Now, in the governor's race and the Senate race, that helps the Democrats because the Republicans don't look that strong at all, and the Republicans may be shut out of the governor's seat, the one that Jerry Brown is giving up, or the Dianne Feinstein Senate seat. Republicans may not even have a candidate in November. Mm-hmm. But in the House races, as Howard just said, let's just say there's a race that so many Democrats want to run and beat, for example, Dana Rohrabacher. So you have 15 Democrats running, and if you only have 1 or 2 Republicans running, it's very possible that the Democratic split and the vote is going to be split in so many different ways that they eliminate each other from finishing first or second. The thing is, there are two ways. So a lot of people are criticizing the Democratic Party for not stepping in and endorsing the candidates they feel are the strongest. At the same time, there are Bernie Sanders or progressive groups or people like that who say the party has no business doing that. Let the people decide. This should not be a boss-decided decision. It should be among the people. So this top two system, this jungle primary, as they call it in California, is really splitting the Democratic Party when on paper, there should be such opportunity for the Democrats to succeed in November.
Well, from what I've read, two of the leading Democrats in that 8-person field in that 48th congressional district, Rohrabacher's district, one of them, Hans Kierstead, is endorsed by the state party, and Harley Ruda is endorsed by the National Democratic Party. So the party apparatus can't get itself together.
Right. And this is in Orange County, California, which is really not the bluest of
to put it mildly.
So yeah, right. And it's difficult enough for Democrats, but it is possible that they could somehow take Rohrabacher out. But not when you have this kind of situation where the Democratic vote is just going to be split all over the map.
Is this, Ken,
and yes,
an example?
Yeah, I was gonna say,
go ahead.
Go ahead. I just want to say one quick thing that, yes, this is Orange County. Yes, this is conservative country. But in many of these districts, Hillary Clinton actually defeated Donald Trump in these congressional districts. So the Democrats even more an opportunity, but not if they eat their own. Right.
So, Ken, is this an example of the Democratic Party's inability to strategize about how to get things done and stepping on themselves? Or is this just in some other district this could be flipped and the Republicans are stepping all over themselves? We're just looking at it at a Democratic district or at a district that has a lot of Democrats who are eating each other.
You know what it reminds me of? There's a congressman in Tennessee. I think his name is Steve Cohn. It's Memphis, where Harold Ford used to be the congressman there for many years. And when Harold Ford Sr. for a long time, succeeded by his son, Harold Ford Jr. When Harold Ford Jr. gave up the seat to run for the Senate, there must have been, I think there were 15, and this is overwhelmingly black district, 15 or so or 10 African-American candidates ran in the Democratic primary, and one white candidate, Steve Cohn, ran, and Cohn and so many black political leaders were imploring some of the candidates, get out of the race, you're splitting up the black vote, you're going to allow a white candidate to win. Everybody had their own agenda, everybody had their own ambition, they stayed in the race, and Steve Cohn won, and he's still in Congress. So I don't blame the party for this. I don't think this is a... First of all, I'm not a fan of this system. I think Democrats should have their primary and Republicans should have their primary, and that's fine.
How long has this system been around?
Schwarzenegger is the one who put it together. So I guess around 2010. And again, it didn't make the kind of difference it's making now, because right now we think that the Democratic base is so energized that a lot of Republican seats could be at risk. But like in 2014, for example, in the Senate race for when Barbara Boxer was retiring, the top two finishers for the Senate were Kamala Harris, a Democrat, and Loretta Sanchez, a Democrat. Republicans didn't even make the top two, so the Republican voters didn't even have a say in the Senate race. In the Senate race this year, Dianne Feinstein and Kevin DeLeon, her challenger from the left, look like the top two Senate candidates. Republicans won't have a candidate. That's why, now this is, I know I'm rambling here, but it really is important. Gavin Newsom is the lieutenant governor of California. He's likely to finish first in the race for governor, in the race for the seat that Jerry Brown is giving up. He desperately wants to run against another a Republican. John Cox is thought to be the leading Republican. Trump has endorsed him. He wants to run against John Cox because he doesn't want to run against a fellow Democrat. But other Democrats are saying, no, you don't want a Republican finishing in the top two, because if you have a Republican at the top of the ticket, it could excite other Republicans to help their congressional candidates as well. So even the Democratic Party candidates, Gavin Newsom and others who are running for governor, are split over what kind of who should be the opponent of Gavin Newsom in the top two. In other words, if you have a Republican on top running for governor, it could help these endangered Republican candidates for Congress, and that's not what the Democratic Party wants either. Did I just make it more confusing?
No, you didn't. I understood that perfectly. But, Dan,
really?
You know what this system in California reminds you of? The primary system for mayor in the city of Cincinnati.
Right.
Where you have a field race and you can get all these votes. You know, you can get black
votes.
But
at this point, Republicans don't even try.
Right. Well, they don't even try. They're not even in the game. But I'm going to say one thing about the Democratic Party in Ohio has done a pretty good job, except for the governor's race this year, where they did have a primary, a contested primary, but it wasn't much of a contest. Dennis Kucinich was never going to win that primary, and Richard Cordray was going to win it the day that he got into it. But down ticket in the Secretary of State, the state auditor, the state treasurer, the other state offices, they cleared the field. And they did that purposefully. They found the candidates. They put the word out, this is our candidate. They didn't formally endorse them, but they managed to create a situation where none of them had primary challengers.
So they were strategic.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a minute here before we got a few minutes before we take our next break. The Mueller investigation, and one of the things I want to raise, Ken, is that this time last week, President Trump was talking a lot about Spygate and how the FBI had planted a spy in his campaign and insisting that various people had a chance to look at the evidence behind the scenes. How did that all turn out for him?
Well, you know something, he is still being echoed on that by Fox News. Sean Hannity is going on over and over again about how the Obama administration put a spy in the Trump campaign in 2016 and spied on them. But not only do most people from Earth know that theory is so ridiculous, even Trey Gowdy, who was you know, reviled for his partisanship during Benghazi when, he went after Hillary Clinton and Benghazi. He says, and of course he's retiring this year, maybe that's why he's so suddenly courageous, but he says that, look, the FBI went after people suspected of having relationships with Russia. It had nothing to do with spying on Trump. It had people have relationships with Russia, and it just so happens that some of those people, like Carter Page and George Papadopoulos, did work for the Trump campaign, but the FBI didn't go after them because of Trump. They went after them because of Russia connections. And so more and more people, look, there are people like Devin Nunes, the congressman from California, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, will always seem to do Trump's bidding in this. But there seems to be more and more feeling in Congress, including among Republicans, that the FBI may have actually done the right thing, maybe doing the right thing. And so that's not going to deter Donald Trump from, running against the intelligence agencies and the FBI and the CIA. But I think more and more people think that, look, these charges are unfounded.
One other aspect of this larger investigation, people being charged, people agreeing to cooperate, is that Donald Trump has become very open to granting pardons. Just this morning, it was announced that Martha Stewart and Ron, the former Illinois Governor Ron Blagojevich, that he's considering pardons for them. There's also the D'Souza pardon. Are these signals by Donald Trump to the people who are being pressured by Mueller, I'm going to take care of you?
I think so. I mean, to me, there's no doubt that when he says that, when he talks about pardoning and things like that, I think he's talking to people like Paul Manafort, his former campaign chair, who has refused to concede anything to the Mueller investigation, and he's fighting it. And basically, the argument is that why, even if you're convicted of something, you can get pardoned by the president. But for the president to call this a witch hunt and a baseless charge and corrupt FBI, the fact is that four or five or maybe six people have already pleaded guilty in this investigation. I think there are 19 indictments so far. Fake news when you have those kind of numbers. I mean, whether there are convictions, that's another question. Whether Robert Mueller comes to the American people and says, look, I don't have what, here's what I have, and it may not be as much as I thought I would have or as much as you want it to have. So ultimately, the decider in this are going to be the American people on November 5th. Ultimately, I think this will be a referendum on Donald Trump, and if you believe in impeachment and you believe in more investigations, you'll vote Democratic candidates for Congress. I mean, this is kind of simplistic, but if you support the president and you believe that president is being railroaded by an over-aggressive intelligence agency and Mueller investigation, you'll vote Republican. That sounds simplistic, but, you go back to 1974, there were a lot of issues on the ballot in 74, but ultimately it was whether Nixon should pay the price for Watergate. And of course, by the time the voters went to the polls in November of 74, Nixon was already out of office. I don't suspect Donald Trump to be out of office anytime soon.
Yes, and Nixon was pardoned by then, too.
Well, that's true.
But I think Ken's exactly right. I mean, it is a referendum on Donald Trump. And, he can keep – and he is sending signals to these people. Stand by me, I'll stand by you. If he's starting to talk about, people like Martha Stewart, well, he's certainly going to stand by somebody like Manafort.
Or Rob Blagojevich.
Well, we do know about Martha Stewart's role in Russian spying. I'm not kidding, but I once heard her say something about Russian dressing on TV. And that, to me, is a clear indication that I have no idea what I'm talking about.
And we have a question. I'm not sure if it came off of a an email or exactly what, but the question is, what's going on with Melania Trump? That she's been out of the spotlight for weeks. There's been of course, a medical issue that started all of this. But there's a tweet that looks like it's from Donald Trump. He wrote it. I don't know, asking the question? What? I'm not quite sure what's happening here. Ken, do you have any insight on Melania?
I don't, and I'll be honest with you, that's something I didn't even want to speculate about. I know she's not been in the public eye in a long time. I know she was in the hospital for some kind of kidney ailment. The White House has not offered any information. They feel it's private. I mean, I personally think that the First Lady's whereabouts and health is our business, but as far as speculation and what's going on, I'm staying out of that one.
Okay.
Yeah. Howard. I'll pass on that, too. Okay. I mean, it's just not, you know, we don't know enough to be able to speak to it.
Okay. There was an incident just in the last couple of days with Roseanne Barr, and she used her Twitter account to attack Valerie Jarrett, who was, of course, a close counselor to President Obama. The reaction was very strong on a popular level in terms of her producer, in terms of the sponsors of her new show. It got canceled. Reruns got canceled. And ABC reached out to Valerie Jarrett to apologize, which then elicited a response from President Trump saying, why didn't he get an apology? Which seemed like a strange sequence of events. Ken, what do you make of all this?
Well, I should tell you that I'm doing the show on Ambien, so that may color my decisions. But this is what's so amazing about this. I mean, look, what ABC did, you know, congratulations to ABC. They made the right move. The thought of making a contemptuous comment about equating an African-American with an ape, the fact that she was the offspring of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Planet of the Apes is just beyond comprehension. But actually, that's what Roseanne Barr has been doing. She peddles in conspiracy theories. She's been doing it for years. I don't care if she supports Trump or Jill Stein or anybody. That's not the point. But some of the things that she peddles on Twitter is just abhorrent, and I kind of think that the people who worked on her show just had to deal with it because the show had been such a success. When Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary, was asked a day or so ago about, you know, or 2 days, whatever, about what the president has to say about the firing of Roseanne, she said, look, the president has other things to be concerned about. You know, there's Korea, there's the economy, there's this and that and this, and he doesn't care about what's going on there. And then the president tweets, I can't believe they apologized to Valerie Jarrett. ABC apologized to Valerie Jarrett. Why don't they apologize to me for all the terrible things they said about me? It's vintage Trump, because it's all about me, 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 me. You know, the famous opera singer, me, 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 me. But it just, it's just so... Yeah. It's just so, oh, God. So.
I've heard.
And
I've,
then the thing is, and one more thing, though. Everybody is trying to say, yes, Roseanne did this, but what about her? What about him? It always like the lonely, what about? Let's just take Roseanne's tweet for what it was, as disgusting as it was, and deal with that. We don't have to compare it to every, you know, Michelle Wolf during the, you know, she insulted Sarah Sanders, or one, she didn't. And two, it's a stupid comparison. Just focus on this for 1 second.
Yeah, and the thing about Roseanne, I've heard or I've seen on social media people saying, well, how could ABC take away her show? She has First Amendment rights. She can speak out on anything she wants. Well, she can. She does have First Amendment rights. She can speak out on anything. But ABC is not required by the Constitution or any other law to give her a television show. And they were right in doing what they did in getting her off of the air after that egregious statement about Valerie Jarrett.
Well, one thing we have to remember is commercial television is a business.
Right.
And when something like that happens, sponsors flee and it hits the bottom line. And that there are implications yes. of doing that. We have someone on the line, Doug, and it takes us back to an earlier topic, but I think it's worth hearing Doug's insight. Doug, you have a view or a thought about the Spygate approach and question.
Correct. So thanks, guys, for making the time. Really enjoy the show. A couple things that you should maybe think about. So the Inspector General, DOJ Inspector General, has scheduled testimony testimony scheduled for June 5th. That is the first of three reports into FBI DOJ activity during the 2016 election. We know for a fact that the DNC server was never turned over to the FBI. It's kind of shocking that occurred. It was kind of the subject of all of this discussion about Russian hacking, but the FBI was never allowed to look at it. There's no doubt that the Inspector General's first report on the handling of the Clinton email investigation, in my view, will show obstruction of justice, destruction of evidence, maybe tampering with 302 interview forms, et cetera. And that is only the first report that's coming out. So the notion that there was surveillance of the Trump administration is not crazy at all. We know that there was a 99-page ruling from Rosemary Collier, the FISA court supervisor, that there was unlawful surveillance occurring. Possibly up to 1,000 individuals were unlawfully surveilled. There's very little.
Okay, I'm going to. I know because of time here. I'm going to let our panel sort of comment on this. Basically, I think what Doug is saying is there's still a lot of information to be looked at and made public in the Spygate question. Ken, any thoughts?
Well, several thoughts. First of all, do I think that Hillary Clinton was above board and the way the Clinton campaign dealt with her email server? Absolutely not. I mean, this is, again, I don't want to go back to, what about Hillary? Because that's what so many people seem to do. The fact is that Hillary Clinton does have a lot, and the campaign has a lot to answer for. But as far as the FBI surveillance of the Trump campaign, there are two people, and I've said this over and over again. Carter Page was seen by the FBI as someone who was either working at the behest of Moscow or having business with Moscow that would seem to affect the candidacy of Donald Trump. So Carter Page was clearly investigated by the FBI because they saw things that he was doing that just seemed wrong. To say that they put a spy inside the Trump campaign, I mean, I'm not sure what Doug is referring to. I don't know if it's exactly the way he's picturing it, but they were clearly, look, if I were President Trump and there were some questionable activities going on in my campaign, I would want the FBI to investigate it, whereas the president seems to say that, no, this was really an attack on his own campaign.
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, that is what FBI does in terms of trying to investigate those kind of charges.
Okay. Doug, thanks for the question, though. It challenges the sort of where we might think we are on this whole thing. I want to raise one other issue that has emerged in the last couple of weeks, and that is the question of how adults, parents, and children who are seeking asylum in the United States, and when they reach the border, they're being separated. Parents and children are being separated. Now, I know some reporting on this got way off base in terms of 1,500 kids lost and all of that kind of stuff. I think that's been discredited in terms of the way it was reported and a lot of the details. But on the substantive question of the way we're treating asylum seekers, I want to raise the question of what is the status of seeking asylum, not only in terms of U.S. law, but in terms of international law and the UN Declaration of on Refugees, both in 1951 and 1967. This is a recognized international question, not just something a particular administration in a particular country can do sort of whatever it wants with.
Howard, you want to take this? Because I really...
No, you're right, Dan. It is there. It's been there for a long time, and it's and no temporary administration can take that away. I think it's really interesting. Tomorrow there are going to be demonstrations in cities all over the country on this issue. It has gotten people very angry that this is going on.
So
There is something, though, that's disappointing, though, when you see, when you hear the Attorney General say, well, if you didn't want these parents and children to be separated, the parents shouldn't have brought the kids to this country anyway. It just, there's a certain coldness to a response like that, that, again, I don't know all the details about the separation of children and how many were missing or whether they were missing or not, but there seems to be something wrong with a society when the top levels of government said, well, if you didn't want your kid to be separated, you shouldn't come into this country anyway. There has to be a more compassionate answer than that. I don't know what that answer should be, but that just seemed just wrong and wrong.
Okay. I want to also ask, we don't know what the status of John McCain is, but given the closeness of the split in the Senate and what, I mean, obviously John McCain is dying. So what are the political implications here? What could happen and when could it happen?
Well, I think if I'm correct, if he's still in the Senate by the end of May, which looks likely to be happening, then if something should happen, if there's a vacancy after that, the person who was appointed by the governor, who is a Republican, will not have to stand for re-election election until 2020. If McCain were to have relinquished his seat before May 31st, there would have had to have been a special election this year, which is not what the Republicans would have liked, because they also have, they have a tough race to keep the Jeff Flake Senate seat, and so they're kind of reeling. I agree with you, Dan. I think it breaks our heart to have to talk about John McCain in political terms, but again, if McCain stays on past May 31st, then any successor would not have to seek his seat until 2020, run for a seat until 2020.
Well, I want to thank Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and Howard Wilkinson for being here today to talk about these issues. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Layla Shakui is the intern. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned on 91.7 for Here and Now.